This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
It's humble!
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Welcome to Olympia, and in particular to this event, which is Thinking on My Feet with the wonderful Kate Humble. Have you always walked?
According to my mum, I was quite precocious in the walking department and walked quite early at about 9 months, which was really annoying for her. And I was given a wheelbarrow. Because, you know, that was the era I was brought up in, where wheelbarrows were seen as good presents for three-year-olds. So I had a children's wheelbarrow that was blue, and I loved it. And I would go on adventures in it with it. And one day I was found a mile and a half away from home with my wheelbarrow. So, yes, I've walked for quite a long time.
And that goes down in sort of family history and is wheeled out, no doubt.
Indeed.
And what about, you know, when you were growing up, and I don't know whether you had a difficult teenagery, but, I mean, were you one of those people who was still outdoors, or were your parents having to drag you off the sofa?
No, I was always quite outdoors. I grew up in the countryside and, was a sort of deeply scruffy, unsophisticated kid who loved horses, actually. So I spent most of my childhood and teenage years mucking things out, covered in, you know, horse hair and horse poo and wondering why I never got a boyfriend. So I had a very kind of outdoor, always had a very outdoor childhood. And I think the thing about growing up in the countryside in the kind of 70s and 80s, you know, and it's so annoying, everyone bangs on about we're all stuck to our screens now and everything else, but it was, I feel so lucky to have grown up in that era where you had to make your own amusement, you had to make your own fun, you climbed trees, you fell out of them, you went to A&E at least, you know, three times before you were 10, otherwise you hadn't had a proper childhood, do you know what I mean? So, and walking was just part and parcel of things, you know, you went for a walk because it was something that you did in the afternoon, because there was nothing else to do, really, when you were growing up in the country. So I do feel, as I say, enormously lucky to have been a child at that time.
How often do you walk now? I mean, go out on a proper humdinger?
When I'm at home, I live in the Wye Valley in Wales, which, if anybody knows, is staggeringly beautiful. I know I'm biased, but it really is lovely. And I have three dogs. I was going to say three energetic dogs. Two of them are getting less energetic. I think I've walked their paws off, poor little things, but they're quite old now. But I have my wonderful sheepdog, Teg, who needs enormous amounts of exercise. So every day is, you know, when I'm at home, it's every single day I will go for a proper humdinger of a walk. We walk for an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours in the morning if I can get away with it, and then maybe another hour in the afternoon. And it's a funny thing, when I was researching and writing this book, one of the things that perhaps some of you will recognise is we now seem to be in a society where you are deemed busy and therefore kind of contributing to society if you're actively doing something. And the problem is, when you're writing, is that a lot of the time you're not actually sitting doing that. A lot of the time it happens, or certainly in my case, it happens in your head. But to the outside world, you're doing nothing. You know, you're just idling about. You know, why aren't you cooking me supper, my husband might say. And I'm like, I'm writing a book. No, you're not. You're just sitting there. And there's a wonderful book by a wonderful writer called Rebecca Solnit. And she wrote a book called Wanderlust. And she talks about this very issue of apparently doing nothing and how you have to disguise, you know, you're doing nothing as doing something. And she says walking is the closest to doing nothing, that you can kind of get away with doing something and you can still have your thought processes. You can still actually be really constructive and creative. In fact, arguably more so when you're walking than when you're sitting down. So it is a great tactic, everybody, if you want to just have a little bit of headspace and work it out and not for everyone else to look at you thinking, oh, they're just sitting there doing bugger all.
But dog or no dog, really, it's fine to go, isn't it?
It totally is. I mean, it is true. I've had a lot of people say to me, yeah, but when you've got a dog, you know, you have that added incentive. You have the sad face, are you going to take me out, or the cross legs, or the, you know. And it's true, you know, that there are days where I've woken up, you know, in the last week, and the rain has been thundering on the skylight in our bedroom, and I'm thinking, you know, but I've got to go out. And so don't think that I am some kind of walking superhero that just simply doesn't notice the weather. I notice the weather like everybody else does. But what I have noticed is even when you feel a little bit like, oh, God, really, have I got to go out? Once you are out, swathed in your unsexiest Gore-Tex outfit, it does feel wonderful, even in the driving rain. You know, there's always something that makes you happy that you have taken yourself away from four walls and got out into the fresh air.
I mean, it really comes across in the book that you are devout about this.
I've become a bit evangelical. But yeah, it is. I think we all do it. When you really love something, when you know how good it makes you feel, and I don't mean that it means that you're a permanent size 8 and, you know, you're mentally perfect. I am none of those things. But I do know that if I am feeling confused about something, if I'm trying to work something out work-wise, if I want to, you know, I'm at an age now where very sadly, you know, people who are close to me are not well or are dying, and you need to be able to process that. And for me, I find that walking is that perfect way of being, and I talk about this quite a lot in the book, of being solitary, which is very different from being lonely. You choose to be solitary, and sometimes you need that space to be able to just work things through, make yourself feel better about something, understand something better, or just, if you wake up, as we all do, let's face it, every now and then, in a bit of a grump, you go for a walk and suddenly, you know, you're less grumpy.
So what did you learn then in terms of, in writing the book, in terms of that relationship between the physicality of putting one foot in front of the other and what it does up here?
Well, it's really interesting, and I was trying to find, I didn't really find anything that, because it feels like such a primeval thing, walking. You know, here we are, this species, this creature that evolved to be bipedal. We evolved to walk. It is, you know, one of the absolute essences of being human. We're not unique in being bipedal, but we are, you know, we are, that is something that's absolutely, you know, part and parcel of being human. And I think, and this is sort of, I'm afraid, my own theory. If there's a wonderful scientist out there who can tell me I'm talking nonsense, please do. But I think, you know, the fact that it is absolutely intrinsic and part of our ancient DNA, that rhythm, and it is such a rhythmic thing, you know, the way that our feet work with the ground does have some extraordinary connection with the way that our brains work, with the way that we experience the world, and with the way that we analyze and process thoughts. And there have been a number of scientific studies, and I read lots of them, about, you know, I mean, a lot of us have become aware, and luckily there's the science to back it up, that being outside in nature is basically very good for us, you know, sort of full stop. It's good for our sense of well-being, it's very good for our mental health. But there have also been kind of academic studies looking at the academic advantages of being out in nature and walking. And some of these studies that were done mainly in America, the results were extraordinary. You know, people who would do a test, they were looking particularly at things like attentiveness, attention span, and creativity and kind of cognitive ability, how well your brain worked, if you like. And so these sort of, you know, clever university types set people a test that they would do before their walk and then send them off for a walk and then get them to do the same test afterwards. And they were able to compare people, so they sent people out into an urban space and then sent another group out into a green space, you know, into a park, and compared the differences. And walking would generally improve people's scores, but walking in nature, in a green space, scores would increase by 20%. Mm. It is amazing. So, you know, I found myself often when I was writing this or, you know, in any area of my work, if you get that kind of stuck feeling, and, you know, you can get that stuck feeling you're trying to write a letter to your accountant or something, you know, or a slightly awkward letter to an annoying neighbour or whatever it might be, I find that going for a walk, it's not like a kind of light bulb going on. It's not like going, oh goodness, I've got the answer, you know, there it is. But something happens. It's like a sort of, I can't think of a better word than
it's magic.
Seeping. A seeping happens where suddenly a solution will kind of present itself. Mm. And I write about a day where I'd had this incident. It was a work-related incident that really upset me, really, really upset me. And I thought it had been resolved, and it hadn't. It sort of reappeared. And it was one of those instances where I couldn't work out whether I was at fault or whether I was actually being kind of unfairly blamed for something. And I simply couldn't work it out, and I couldn't work out what my response should be to it and how I should deal with it, how I should cope with it. And I don't know about you, there is something slightly annoying about being a middle-aged woman that you don't sleep that well anyway, particularly if you've had a glass of wine. How annoying is that? You can't drink wine anymore. Anyway, so, you know, I was awake all night kind of worrying, you know, and all those endless sort of what-ifs and if I'd done that and have I, you know. And I got up in the morning, really that awful jangled feeling and that knot you get, you know, that anxiety knot. It's like a nasty little animal curled up in your stomach. And I went for a walk with the dogs and really didn't feel like it. Didn't feel like walking, just felt really quite miserable and as I say, just anxious. And animals, as I'm sure many of you know, have this sort of unerring ability to know when you're a little bit out of sorts. So they were just brilliant. You know, the dogs were brilliant. They were just kind of mucking around and, you know, everything to try and distract me. They knew that I wasn't really concentrating on them and that I was sort of, you know, in my head. So they were a kind of wonderful way of and the combination of that, of being outside, of, you know, the birds singing despite the fact that I was gloomy, the sun coming up despite the fact that it felt like a dark day, you know, bloody hell, nature's being wonderful, you know, and I'm feeling grim.
How dare it?
And by the end of the walk, a solution hadn't presented itself, but I felt much less wound up. Mm. The little kind of evil creature was still there but didn't seem quite as evil anymore. Mm. And then I was back at my desk, I was, you know, working, and Teg, my lovely ginger sheepdog, she has this very clever tactic when she wants me to stop working and pay attention to her. So I'll be typing and she'll come in, and she's about chair height. She comes in and she puts her head underneath my arm. So I'm trying to type and then she just lifts her head up. So I'm like, I can't. I'm like, bloody dog. And she's got these amazing eyes and she just sort of looks at me in the kind of, when you're like, I'm lost. I can't refuse you. And so we went out for another walk, and on that walk, that seeping thing happened. Mm. And this sort of solution started to come in my head, and I started to compose the email that I would write that I felt was the most honest and heartfelt response that I could give to this situation. And I wrote it completely in my head as I was walking along. I got back, I just typed it instantly. Luckily, Teg, wasn't there doing this. I typed it, sent it, and it was just like this huge weight gone. And I know I wouldn't have been able to do that without a walk and a slightly annoying dog.
And one of the wonderful things about being a middle-aged woman is that actually you now have that experience and you know what to do next time, which, let's face it, at 18, we don't necessarily.
That's it. That is. I mean, you know, I there's a bit in here, you know, about, I talk about age because, you know, it is a thing. Mm. Suddenly, oh, my God, you know, I'm 50. How the bloody hell did that happen? but actually, the really wonderful things about it, and I have a very dear friend who lives on the other side. She lives on the English side of the valley. She's a writer, far better writer than me. We've coincided writing books, so we send each other texts and things sometimes, you know, doing word count versus number of Twixes eaten, and we often walk together. I love walking by myself, but equally walking with somebody that you know really well, where silences are never awkward, and that is a lovely thing about walking. And I'll get on to the idea of first dates and see what you think about that in a minute. But we've had lovely conversations. You know, we're similar age. I'm a bit older than her, but we've just had lovely conversations about exactly those sorts of things. The joys of getting older. The kind of, you know, the things that don't bother you anymore, that you don't care about anymore, or that you care deeply about. And they're quite uncool, and you don't care that anyone thinks it's uncool. but it was funny. Walking has been talked about as great therapy. And I'd read about this. And there is a therapist in New York, of course, in New York, called Clay Cockrell. I mean, how fabulous. Only in America do you have a therapist called Clay Cockrell. And I'm not going to say that he came up with the idea of, because I'm sure people have been doing walking therapy, if you like, for generations. It just hasn't been called it, or you haven't had to pay for it. You've just hoiked a mate out and said, take me for a walk and make me feel better. But he does it as, you know, as a proper form of therapy. And, you know, it seems that everybody in New York has to be in therapy of some description or another. And he had a client working, a lot of his clients work in the financial sector, you know, hugely stressful. They might make lots of money, but they have no work-life balance. You know, their family, they never see their families, blah, blah, blah. You know, some people, I mean, it's kind of staggering, but understandable. The amount of money they have makes them miserable. You know, there is such a thing, actually, I think, as having, well, I don't know, I've never had it, but, you know, you see the uber rich who are just sort of, you know, ripped apart by the, what do I do with my money, or does anybody only like me because I've got money, you know. So there's a lot of anxiety in that sector and stress and everything else. And one of his clients worked on Wall Street, and he would never make his appointments. So they were kind of getting nowhere. He'd been seeing him for 6 months, except that most of the time he wouldn't turn up, or he'd turn up late and he'd never have his full session. And Clay's wife said to Clay one day, who was sort of despairing and quite worried about this man, who was clearly in a bad way, his wife said to him, well, why don't you go to his office? And he said, oh, don't be, that's the whole point. We need to remove people from the environment that's making them stressed. I can't possibly see him in his office. And she said, well, I don't know, take him for a walk, go to the park. And he went, I can't. Maybe there's something in that. And he said, you know, if you think about it, and this is probably true of lots of people living and working in cities, you know, you live in a box, you get in another box, be it a train or a car or a tube or whatever, to travel to work, and then you sit in another box and work. You spend your life boxed in. I mean, quite literally boxed in. So he thought, maybe my wife is onto something here. And he suggested to the client, we could walk around Battery Park. You know, it's right on the edge of Wall Street. And the client was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't do a New York accent, but you get the picture, you know, yeah, let's do it, let's do it. So they walked around Battery Park, and he said the brilliant thing for him as a therapist was that he could suddenly read somebody's body language so clearly. Because when you're sitting in a chair, you might look relaxed or not, or you might do that or whatever. But when you're walking, you can't hide what you're feeling. And this man had fists clenched, shoulders up here, marching 100 miles an hour. And within 20 minutes, Clay could see that his whole body language changed. He started to relax, his hands started to unclench, and he started to walk with a rhythm rather than a scamper. Mm. And Clay said in that first session, they achieved more than they had in the previous 6 months. And he said one of the things that he thought really helped, and this is where I'm coming to the first date thing here, is that all of us, feel free to shout at me if I'm wrong, but a lot of men in particular don't like that face-to-face confrontation. If you're sitting in a room with somebody, or you're on a first date and you're sitting across a table in a restaurant worried about whether you've got spaghetti on your chin, it's quite confrontational. You don't want to speak. It's not that comfortable. Side by side, there's nothing awkward about not making eye contact all the time, because if you do, you're probably going to fall over and make a tit of yourself. So, you know, you don't have that awkwardness of, I don't really want to look at you because I'm embarrassed or I'm sad or I'm awkward or whatever it is. That awkwardness goes away. And also, when you're walking and you're side by side and you're not stuck in that kind of boxed-in environment, silence is an entirely natural thing. Thinking is an entirely natural thing. You don't suddenly feel like, gosh, I've got to fill in this gap, because nature does that for you. And so Clay, having had the great success with this one client, went, well, you know, he's got to compete with a million other therapists in New York. Maybe this can be my point of difference. Maybe I will offer, I won't say it's the only thing I do, but maybe I will offer people the chance to have their therapy while walking. And that was 12 years ago, and that's what he does. And he takes people around Central Park, and he has changed people's lives just by that very, very simple act of taking somebody for a walk.
And it's something that you've adapted a little bit, or certainly taken pieces of, in terms of meetings. You talk in the book about how creative you can be, if you know, rather than sitting in an office with a laptop and a PowerPoint screen.
Absolutely. I'm sure, again, we've all done it. You know, you've gone in for a meeting, or you've gone in for a job interview, or you've gone in and you know, again, you sort of slightly feel under the cosh, and you've got to do this. I didn't do terribly well at school, and I think it was because I just never did well in that kind of hemmed in. I always felt hemmed in. I was more concentrating on being hemmed in than I was on, you know, learning my history dates or whatever it was I should be doing. And actually, there are a lot of people, you know, Steve Jobs famously, the Apple man, famously would have his meetings while walking. Bill Gates the same. You know, some people who have made quite a success of their lives have had their meetings on foot. There's a TED talk by a woman whose name I can't quite remember, but she basically, again, was a great proponent of having, you know, she's a very successful entrepreneur, great proponent of having her meetings while walking. I had a day, one of those days that we all have where you think, how am I going to fit everything in? And I did have to walk the dogs, but I also had a meeting and everything had got jumbled up and I hadn't been able to walk the dog. And I phoned the person that I was meeting and said, I know this sounds desperately unprofessional, but would you mind coming and walking my dogs with me? It was brilliant. It was the most creative meeting. She loved it. I loved it. We got everything talked about that we needed to. Went away. It was the most productive meeting I've ever had. And so I think, you know, it is... I know it's sort of... It sounds like a well-worn cliche, but to literally think outside the box actually can be a very useful and proactive thing to do.
So take us to the Wye Valley then. When you take a walk from your house with Teg at your side, yeah, and possibly the other two as well, yeah, what do you go out into? What do you see?
Oh, I've been away from home for, it's only 3 days and I'm feeling homesick already. I live on a hill. Not quite. I live in a very old farmhouse of the still working farm next door. It was built probably in the 17th century. We're not entirely sure. But my goodness, they knew how to build houses in those days. So it's not on the top of the hill. It's actually built into the kind of summit of the hill. So, and it's of the local stone. So you can't really see the house. It disappears beautifully. But it looks out over the Wye Valley, and I look back at England. So I don't have a Welsh bone in my body, but I seem to have adopted... I have this... there's a wonderful word called hiraeth, a Welsh word called hiraeth, and it doesn't have a proper translation, really, but it's sort of longing or yearning. And I have developed this hiraeth for Wales, weirdly, as I say. I have, as far as I know, not a shred of Welsh DNA. But I love it. But it is still lovely to be able to look back at England. So I'm right on the border. The Wye Valley, or the River Wye, where I am, in the lower part of the Wye Valley, forms the border. Mm. And opposite us is another ridge, and that's Offa's Dyke, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, a lovely long-distance footpath that goes from Chepstow pretty much to Liverpool, to very much North Wales. And it's very wooded. We're very forested in our neck of the woods, as it were. Some conifer, but lots of beech and oak. So this autumn, after that incredible summer, the colours were mind-blowing. And every morning, because the river's down in the valley, and you can't see the river from where we are, but you get that wonderful temperature inversion that happens often in the autumn, where you get, it looks like someone's been out and sprayed dry ice along the river. So I can't see the river, but I can see this wonderful mist, just low down in the valley below me. And there I am, all smug, out of the mist, hopefully in the sunshine. So I have a view. I'm spoilt the moment I walk out of the door, because I have a view that changes, not just every day, but every moment of the day. And I've looked at that view every day for 11 years, and I still stand there going, how has this happened? How have I got so lucky? And there's no road to our house. It's just a track, very rough track. I had somebody, and I'm terribly sorry if you're slightly sensitive and don't like bad language, but I'm quoting here. It's not my language. Someone came to our house quite early on when we moved in, and it's quite a difficult track to navigate, and it was very, very rough. We've filled in some of the holes, but it was very, very rough. And he drove up to the front door, got out of his car, slammed the door and went, do you just hate people? I said, yeah.
Pretty much.
So the lovely thing, the really spoilt thing, and in fact the reason why the house, I mean, there were all sorts of reasons why we fell in love with the house, but one of the principal reasons was that there are footpaths in every direction from it. So if I walk downhill, I go through the woods, and I can go all the way down to, we live on a little tributary of the Wye called the Angiddy, and it's a wonderful stream. There are dippers, which are really smart if you're not a birder. They're really smart little black and white birds that dip, and that's why they have their name, and they're in that stream. They're quite difficult to see. You don't see them everywhere, but we feel very lucky we've got dippers on our stream. And lots of grey wagtails, and it's beautiful. In the spring, in kind of late April and May, it's full of bluebells because it's principally beech wood, so it's absolutely glorious. And there are fishing ponds down there that the dogs love to swim in. And then there's a huge climb, so you're earning your breakfast, you feel really good. Climb back up through the woods, and then I cut through and up into the fields, and I can get a view back over to the Black Mountain, so the lovely pointy outline of the sugar loaf and the piece of cheese that is the skirrid, and the big flat-topped blorange, which is the mountain on the edge of Abergavenny. So it's a lovely mix. Or I can go up through the fields behind the house, and there's a public footpath called the Winecliffe, which is literally a path that runs along the top of the cliff, really sheer limestone, but wooded cliff above the River Wye. But there's one little place where you can drop down And there's a proper viewing area, and it's called the Eagle's Nest. And it's the perfect name. You do feel like you're in a eyrie looking out over this wonderful view. There's this big bend in the River Wye, and you can see Chepstow. And Chepstow Castle, a bit like our house, is built of the local stone. And you have to really look. You know, it just merges so beautifully into the cliffs around the Wye. And you can see the racecourse where they have the Welsh Grand National down below you. And then the Seven Bridges. And they're this lovely brace of bridges, the old bridge that comes over to Chepstow and the new one. And then there are all sorts of permutations around that. There was one day when dog number one, my badger, who's a rescue dog, had a terrible, terrible, brutal start in life. And we had him on his own for a couple of years because he was so traumatised, so we needed to teach him how to be a dog again. We set off for a walk one day, and we walked 15 miles from our front door, and I think we maybe were on a road for 200 metres of that 15 miles. So we're very, very, very spoiled.
Mm. One of the wonderful things about the book is it goes through the year, and you really get a sense of your love of that familiarity, because some people might think, you know, it's the same walk, but what you really bring out in it is that it's never the same walk, really.
No,
is it?
No, it never is. And I think actually that was something that, funnily enough, I worked with Bill Oddie for a long time on Spring Watch. And he would talk, you know, Bill has lived in Hampstead in North London for a very, very long time, and he would talk with real just passion for his patch. You know, it was his bit of Hampstead Heath where he would go and go birding and just go and be, you know. And Bill, has been well discussed and talked about, he's talked about it himself, has had some really severe mental health issues. And his patch, he would talk to me about, you know, going out onto his patch, and it would be really, you know, really therapeutic for him, a real way of being able to deal with difficult days. And I remember thinking, I think I'd get bored of that, you know, of doing the same walk. But now I have my patch. And I'll vary it sometimes, but as you said, you know, every time you do a route, it's going to change. And I have one particular route, and it takes about an hour. And it's the route that I always do when I've been away from home. It's the first walk that I do when I come back, because it's the walk that I think of as my patch. And part of it, which sort of slightly oddly for me, part of it is because we have neighbours who live along that patch. You know, we're all sort of spread out and dotted about in fields, in funny little houses in the woods, you know. But it's a nice way of just touching base. I'm back. And they may or may not be in their gardens or, you know, our nearest neighbour's there with her dogs and mucking out her horses or whatever it is. But so part of it is, I I'm back. What's the state of the grass? You know, what's happening to the leaves? What's happening to the view? But also, how's my next door neighbour? You know, her dog hasn't been very well. Last time I was there, he's looking great. Hooray, you know. And another neighbour who's in a shocker will say, is it time for a gin and tonic? And you're going, no, it's 9:30 in the morning. But it is a lovely way of feeling like you, particularly when you've been away, and I do have this very sort of peripatetic life, I feel like it's a reconnection. It is feeling like I am properly home, beyond, you know, coming back, unpacking your bag and putting things in the washing machine, which doesn't really do it.
No. Okay, let's get the microphone out. There's a question here straight away, and if anybody else has got one, pop your hands up and we'll come to you in a second.
Gosh, are we all wilting? It's boiling, isn't it? I was dressed for the snow.
Hi, Kate. I've seen quite a few of your programmes, and apparently you're off to Mongolia next week. I was just wondering whether you were there primarily to follow the tribe or whether you got any hiking done. And the second part is, are you thinking of perhaps following in Julia Bradbury's footsteps and doing, say, 100 coastal walks of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, or maybe you might team up together to do a series?
So I don't know how well you could hear that question. The first one was about Mongolia and Living with Nomads series that's being repeated, actually. It was first shown a couple of years ago on BBC Two. It's being repeated on BBC Four at the moment. And it was the most incredible, incredible series to make. I went and lived alongside three different nomadic groups, one in Nepal, really the last, and they really are the last handful of nomadic people left in Nepal, a group called the Raute, incredibly difficult people. Everybody hates them. They absolutely hated me and want nothing to do with me for quite a long time until I turned out to be relatively useful because I can carry heavy things uphill. And I love them in the end, absolutely love them, but they made my life difficult. And then with the Nenets in Siberia, extraordinary reindeer herders who live in one of the most brutal environments. I was there in the winter, so the coldest temperature we had was minus 57, which is just indescribable. You don't know what happens to your nose hairs. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I didn't know I had nose hairs until I'd been there. And then, as you said, Mongolia, which is... I didn't know. No one ever tells you when programs are being repeated, so I didn't know. I don't know what day it's going out. It might be. Is it Tuesday? So Tuesday will be the program that I did in Mongolia, and I promise I'm not being paid or anything to say this, but the trip was organised by a company that are exhibiting here called Panoramic Journeys. And if anyone is interested in going to Mongolia, what's wonderful about that company is that they have teams on the ground, local teams on the ground. So ours was a big ask. You know, we wanted to find a nomadic family to go and live with. You can't just get that out of a brochure or on Google. We really needed really good local help. And Panoramic Journeys, Karina Morton at Panoramic Journeys, helped set up all the groundwork for that trip. What's lovely is that I saw her. I'd never met her. We've emailed lots, we've talked lots on the phone. I'd never met her. I met her for the first time today. And we did a little video for the family that I lived with. And, you know, I can still stay in touch with them because they were remarkable. As far as the second part of that question, did I have time for hiking? No. I mean, basically, they put me to work. I was there, you know, living alongside them, doing whatever they wanted to do. And you know, I was, thanks to their extraordinary generosity, really treated as part of the family. So we couldn't just sort of go off and have a one. You don't have days off when you're doing that sort of thing. As for the Julia Bradbury part of your question, you know, am I following her footsteps? I think she's doing a very good job on her own.
Are you tempted, though, to sort of make a collection of your favourite walks or to suggest things to... I mean, you might want to keep the Wye Valley to yourself.
Well, yeah, although I've sort of blown it, haven't I? I've talked about it a lot, but I think it's just... It's one of those things that comes up. I think, you know, walking is a difficult thing because it is very personal and it is very subjective. One of the things that I didn't want to do with this book, and I hope I have avoided it, is sort of hector. You must walk. It will make you feel better. What I just wanted to do was encapsulate how it makes me feel, the wonderful encounters, surprising, amazing encounters that you have when you're on foot. That sense of it being very egalitarian. I think that's what I love about walking. You know, everybody is the same when you're walking. Yes, I wanted it, to be, I suppose, an ode to something that I loved, rather than telling everybody that they should do it, and not really being a guide either. You know, would somebody want to make it into a television series? I'm not sure they would, and I'm not sure that wasn't the point of it. You know, it was never its intention. This was something that it was very personal, is very personal, and I don't feel the need for it to take another form. If that makes any sense at all.
Absolutely, yeah. Question over here.
This isn't so much a question, but just a comment. Just first of all, I think that Freud started off, or Jung,
he did,
walking with his patients.
He did.
Before he got into the therapy room and all that business. And then I also was on a mindfulness retreat this last weekend, first ever, and I was reading your book. And I talked about, at the end, just how much that resonated, particularly when we did a silent walk all together.
Oh, how lovely.
And that I, too, have had some brilliant experiences on my own. Once I was in Varanasi and bumped into this lovely man who wanted to marry me straight away. But we had a fantastic time.
That's another story.
And yes. Once I was in Jerusalem. And I had the most memorable day of my life there. So it's been fantastic.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Any other questions? Lady at the front here. That's why he's so slim, all that scampering.
Thank you. If I just say that watching your programme, and I know it's about walking, but...
Hold it really close.
Sorry. When watching your programme, the family moved along and they packed up in 3 hours. We've got everything ready the day before. We're going to Cornwall and it takes us 3 hours to pack the car.
I know.
So it actually shows how you can strip everything away, and walking does just that.
I mean, that was one of the things. You know, it's always a privilege to go and be allowed to be part of somebody else's life. And you know, if you think about it, if I think too hard about it, I can't believe that anyone has ever let us do it. You know, we turn up. And, of course, it's not just me. There is a crew. We've got pigeons. Hello, girls. You know, we've got a crew. We're quite a small gang, but we're a gang nonetheless. And, you know, we're turning up and wanting to be part of people's lives. The Nanettes, which you didn't see in the programme or wasn't a part of the programme, for various reasons, partly the weather, our plan, the family that we were supposed to go and stay with, we couldn't get there. We had all sorts of... It was so cold. We had diesel vehicles, truckles, these big kind of Russian things that can go over tundra. But it was so cold, the diesel froze. And anyway, it was a very, very long story. But we basically lost the family that we were going to be with. We couldn't get to them. So we had to go and basically just find somebody and see if they would allow us to film with them. And there was a scene, I don't know whether you saw it, but at that time of year, the Nanettes are, they sort their reindeer, and some of them are slaughtered and some of them they keep for breeding, and that's their income for the rest of the year. And they gather at the slaughterhouses. And so we went there because we knew that's where we would find them. They're nomadic. You can't just kind of, you know, look them up on Google Maps. You have to go and, you know, you have to physically go and find them. And we knew they would be gathered there. We knew we'd find Nanette's people there. I'd helped out during the day, and then there's a little hut that everyone gathers to have their tea, and I was helping the women make tea. And then I literally sat down next to this woman that I'd been helping make tea with and said, can we come and stay? Can we come and stay with you? We're making a film, and we want to make the most faithful film we can about your culture and you and your lives, but we kind of need somebody to allow us to come and stay. We've got tents. We don't have to, you know, infringe. And she said, don't be ridiculous. You'll die. You'll sleep with us. And that is like me just coming up to you and saying, hello, I'm moving in. Do you mind? You know, with all my kit. And I mean, that sort of level of generosity is so extraordinary. And as you say, you know, you've got, there is a wonderful, it's not a simplicity in that people are not clever or anything else. It is just, there is that lovely, stripped back, old fashioned, sense of you look after people, you're hospitable. If somebody is living with you, they are their responsibility. You know, I've never felt so safe as I have when I am filming with, you know, nomadic people or with, you know, with tribal people in different parts of the world. Because, and as you say, their packing up is an awful... We turn up with kind of 40 pieces of luggage. you know, and they just bung everything on the back of a sled and they're off. Yeah.
You've got a sense of this book from what the way that Kate's told her stories, obviously, but the way that you weave in your exploits in other parts of the world and then come back to the Wye Valley through the year is absolutely lovely. It's not hectoring at all. It's very enthusiastic. Please do go and join Kate over in the author's tent where she'll be signing, carrying on the conversation. Thank you to you for coming and for your
Thank
questions.
You. Thank you,
Kate Humble.
Thank you. Thank you, Julia. That was brilliant.